So thank you very much, Eric. It's a real pleasure to give a colloquium here. I, of course, know Toronto very well from childhood, but this is, I think, the first time I've given a talk in this room. So thank you very much for inviting me. Before we get to quark gluon plasma, I want to begin at the beginning. The quark gluon plasma is the high-temperature phase of QCD. Well, what is QCD? What does it describe? Why should we be studying its phase diagram? So what is QCD? Well, if someone gave you the laws of QCD, which can be written on a single sheet of paper very easily, and you looked at them, you would see quarks and you would see gluons written on that sheet of paper, and you would conclude that it was a theory very much like the theory that describes how electrons interact. Electrons are spin one-half particles. They interact by exchanging photons. Quarks are spin one-half particles. They interact by exchanging gluons. And at this level, the differences all sound like technicalities. Yes, over here the photons are neutral. Over here the gluons are charged. In QCD, there are three charges, not just one. All electrons have the same charge minus. Quarks can be green, red, or blue. Gluons, therefore, can have a charge of their own because they can change the color of the quarks. The gluons can interact themselves. All this sounds like technical details. It basically looks the same. Yes, there are six different quarks. They have different masses. But none of that sounds like a qualitative difference between the theory of electrons and the theory of quarks. The qualitative difference comes about when you start to think about the vacuum. In any quantum field theory, whether the theory of electrons or the theory of quarks, the vacuum is not an empty place. It's just happens to be the lowest energy state of the theory, but it's a state that's filled with excitations. It's just the lowest energy arrangement of the fields of the theory. And so when you stick an electron into the vacuum, it polarizes the vacuum around it. When you stick a quark into the vacuum, it polarizes the vacuum around it. And so if you ask, what is the force between electrons? Well, that's described by this 1 over 137 that we learn in undergraduate classes. But when you study quantum field theory, you learn that this 1 over 137 actually changes when you probe electrons at shorter and shorter distances. They interact more strongly. The 1 over 137 rises. And the qualitative difference between the theory of electrons and that of quarks is that in QCD, the alpha of QCD, which tells you how strong the force is, gets smaller at short distances and larger at long distances. And it's this phenomenon here called asymptotic freedom which is responsible for the fact that in experiments which probe matter at very, very short distances, you can actually see the quarks. And it's this phenomenon here, the strong interactions at long distances, that's responsible for the fact that if you ask not what is QCD but what does it describe, you get a very different answer. We're used to, in the theory of electrons, we have currents of electrons flowing in wires. There's no such thing as a current of color of quarks flowing in wires. We're used to photons propagating across the room as a laser beam. There are no gluon lasers. And the reason for this is that it's an experimental fact that in the world around us, quarks and gluons only occur in heavy colorless packages, protons, neutrons, pions, kaons. And the way to think about this is that these are the quasi-particles of the QCD vacuum. If you start with the vacuum and excite it and ask what can propagate across the room, it's not the analog of electrons and photons, it's these complicated beasts. So the QCD vacuum has complicated quasi-particles that look very different than the elementary actors in the theory. And this is why it's interesting. Why it's interesting and why it remains a challenge. So why should we study QCD? Well, it's the only example we know of a strongly interacting gauge theory. If you talk to Bob Holdham or Eric Poppitz, they can tell you that one possibility for what we may discover at the LHC is a new strongly interacting sector responsible for electroweak physics. Maybe so. We'll find out in a couple of years from experiments done at ATLAS and CMS. But right now, we only have one strongly interacting gauge theory we know of, so let's try and understand it. So how are we doing? Well, we understand it very, very well at short distances where the coupling is weak. But at long distances, the quasi-particles, the excitations of the vacuum, are complicated. We don't understand them well because they don't look like the short-distance degrees of freedom. So how do you respond to this challenge? Well, one path is study those quasi-particles. So do electron scattering off of protons. This is done at SLAC, at HERA in Germany, at Jefferson Lab. Study those quasi-particles to death. The other possibility is get away from the vacuum. If the vacuum has difficult quasi-particles to understand, if it's complicated, maybe there are other simpler phases. This question was posed immediately after the discovery of QCD. Are there other phases of the theory in which the quasiparticles look more like the quarks and gluons, and perhaps look more like phases that are familiar from QED? And asymptotic freedom, this weakening of the interactions at short distances, tells us we should look either for circumstances where quarks are close together, or essentially equivalently when they interact at large momentum transfers. So look at high densities or high temperatures. And this is the path that we'll follow in this talk. And however, you should be very skeptical of that argument if you know anything about condensed matter physics. Because in condensed matter physics, the fundamental coupling is 1 over 137. It's a very small number. And yet there are solids, liquids, gases. There are superconductors and superfluids. There are antiferromagnets. There are ferromagnets. There's an extraordinarily rich phase diagram of phenomena in the theory of electrons, ions, and photons. And in QCD, if we go to higher densities and temperatures, we can weaken the interaction a little bit, but we'll never get it down to 1 over 137. So if anything, the condensed matter physics of QCD should be more rich and interesting than conventional condensed matter physics. So this idea that you'll find simpler phases should be challenged. So here is a cartoon of the phase diagram of QCD as a function of temperature and basically density. It's actually a chemical potential is what we plot, but just think of it as density. So going to the right means squeeze matter. Going up means heat matter. In red is, in broad brush strokes, what you might expect to find if you can vary these parameters. So at low temperatures and densities, we have a gas of the quasiparticles of the vacuum, a gas of pions, protons, and their friends. At high densities, if I go very, very high density but keep the temperature cold, then I have a soup of quarks. Those quarks attract, and they form a superconductor. This stuff would be the subject of a different colloquium, one that I could have given but chose not to give. And the way to study this stuff experimentally, how are you going to make dense matter without heating it up? The only answer we know is build a neutron star. So then we go start talking to Martin van Kerkwijk and ask him, what can he tell us about the properties of neutron stars that might constrain theoretical ideas that we come up with about their interiors? And that's the other colloquium that I'm not giving today. On this axis, well, the early universe started out hot, so it started up here. It cooled down this axis, passing through this QCD scale of a couple of hundred MeV when it was a few microseconds old. And on this axis, we think that if you go from a hadron gas upwards in temperature, ultimately, way up here somewhere, you will reach that weakly interacting quark-gluon plasma that was speculated about in the 1970s. The early universe started out filled with quark-gluon plasma. It expanded and cooled, and when it was a few microseconds old, it turned into protons and neutrons and pions. Experiments done with heavy ion collisions are trying to recreate this regime. You take two nuclei, which live here, you put them in an accelerator, slam them together at very high energies, and make a little droplet of quark-gluon plasma, you hope, which is up here on the phase diagram. It expands and cools also, going downward on the phase diagram. That expansion and cooling happens not in microseconds, but in 10 to the minus 22 seconds, so much faster. But you should think of heavy ion collisions as reproducing the history of the universe, but in very small volumes, much smaller than the universe, and very rapidly, much faster than the universe did. And my colloquium will be about this region of the phase diagram here, so I want to tell you about some of the things we know from the theoretical side, and then talk about the experiments. And then talk about how theory is responding to those experiments. So on that vertical axis of the phase diagram, we know a lot about thermodynamics of QCD. We know a lot from lattice QCD. Lattice QCD is the theoretical method of calculation that is the from first principles approach. It's the approach where you just calculate. I won't describe it more than that. But if you can calculate something in lattice QCD, then you know it. And we can calculate a lot of things. We can, in fact, calculate essentially anything thermodynamic, anything about the static properties. And we learn that QCD does, in fact, go from a gas of hadrons to a plasma of quarks and gluons, and that there's a crossover temperature of around 175 MeV, 10 to the 6th electron volts in temperature, and that this transition is a smooth crossover, just like the ionization of a gas. To give you one example of a lattice calculation that leads to this conclusion, here is a calculation, now a number of years old, of the energy density of QCD in units of T to the fourth as a function of temperature. And if we remember in statistical mechanics, when you have a relativistic gas, the energy density goes like number of degrees of freedom times T to the fourth. So this is like counting degrees of freedom. And you see that there's a dramatic change in the number of degrees of freedom from that characteristic of a gas of pions to this value up here, which is within 20% of the ideal non-interacting quark-gluon plasma. And so this change in the physics of QCD, which you can see occurs over a narrow range of temperatures but continuously, is the transition to what we call the quark-gluon plasma. So this stuff up here is quark-gluon plasma. Okay, so now how do I do these experiments? Well, I'm not going to tell you. I'm not an experimentalist. But I will show you one picture, which is the same one that was on the poster. When you take two gold nuclei at Brookhaven National Laboratory at a facility called RIC, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider, and accelerate them so that they're Lorentz contracted by about a factor of 100. So you should think of these two nuclei as pancakes colliding. And then you ask what comes out. This is a single event as imaged by the star detector. This detector is roughly the size that you see on the overhead transparency. It's actually a little bigger than that. I think it's more like 5 meters in diameter. But this is the right scale. So right there in the middle, there was a collision. And for the first 10 to the minus 20 second, 22 seconds, as the matter expanded by, you know, over a length scale, which can be measured in 10 to the minus 15s of meters, that's called a femtometer, a Fermi, we had a quark-gluon plasma, but then it fell apart into a bunch, clearly a very large bunch, of pions mostly, and those pions make tracks in the detector. And so in the final state, you see on the order of 5,000 particles. Actually, this detector, given its acceptance, sees about 2,000 particles. So that's 2,000 particles in a single event, and it is a tribute to the skill of our experimental friends that in that environment, what you can tell is a challenge. They've been able to make beautiful measurements, several of which I'll tell you about. So if you ask what is the purpose of these experiments, given the phase diagram that I drew, you can't ask some yes-no question. You can't go ask your experimental friends, did you make a quark-gluon plasma, yes or no? Because there's no sharp boundary between ordinary pions and the quark-gluon plasma. It's like ionization. It occurs continuously. So if you ask what is the goal of these experiments at RIC, it's to create matter that's above the crossover and study its properties. And that's a simple phrase with three parts. I first of all have to tell you what I mean by matter. What I mean by matter is some sort of a fluid which is behaving collectively and which I can describe with words like temperature, pressure, entropy, density, and not just a bunch of non-interacting particles. By the time you look at the final state with all those tracks, those pions are many meters apart from each other. They're not interacting anymore. But very early on, did we have matter behaving collectively? And this is actually the most subtle part of the phrase, actually. And it turns out that data from RIC, which I'm going to talk about on a quantity that I'll define on the next transparency, to tell you the message, they tell us that the interactions are sufficiently to yield approximately equilibrated matter, expanding collectively and behaving as a fluid by a time about one Fermi or even less after the collision. Now, what's one Fermi? One Fermi is the time it takes light to cross a proton. So one Fermi is a short time scale, and this is a remarkable result. And after that, hydrodynamics, by which I mean ideal hydrodynamics, pretending that the system has zero mean free path, describes the system quite well. So, yes, it's matter, and I'll discuss this at length in the next 10 minutes. Is it above the crossover? That turns out to be a much easier question to answer experimentally. It's very easy to show, using experimental data, that the energy density one Fermi after the collision was greater than 5 GeV per cubic Fermi. And is that above the crossover? So we now go back to our theory calculation here and ask, where is 5 GeV per cubic Fermi on this plot? And the answer is it's right about there. So what we've learned very straightforwardly from the data is that one Fermi after the collision, you're there if you're in equilibrium. And it's not straightforward to see that in fact you are in to a good approximation in equilibrium. That's the challenging part, actually. So let's talk more about how we learn that from the data that these collisions are equilibrating so fast. And at the same time, we're going to learn about how you can measure the first property of the quark-gluon plasma that I'll talk about, which is its shear viscosity. And this subject really has become experimentally driven. And one way to tell that is that if you go back and look, go back on the webpage of some conference in circa 2000 and look at a talk on heavy ion physics, and no one will ever mention shear viscosity. Since 2001, anyone talking about this subject begins with shear viscosity. And that's because of the experimental data that I'll talk about now. So what's the observable? Well, it's called elliptic flow. So what the heck is that? So what you do is you look at collisions in which, so here's a gold nucleus that was going into the board, here's one that was coming out, and they collided not head-on. So they collided with non-zero impact parameter. So what you want to make this statement in a prejudiced way, you want to study quark-gluon plasma, which is formed in this red volume. Okay, and this red volume is not circular. So, before you can justify that statement, you have to rule out the following null hypothesis. Suppose instead of making a matter here, I just have 100 collisions, 100 elementary proton-proton collisions that happen to occur in that red almond, and no particle from any one of those collisions interacts with any of the others. So I have lots of independent PP collisions. Then by the law of large numbers, the final state of 100 proton-proton collisions will be uniformly distributed in azimuthal angle. On the other hand, if I get to use words like equilibration and pressure, so if the interactions are strong enough that I should think about this as red stuff as a fluid, then what do I expect? Well, the pressure is biggest in the center and it's zero on the edge, and therefore the pressure gradients are biggest left to right and smallest up to down. So when this thing explodes, if you can think of it as a fluid, it should explode anisotropically. You should get much greater momentum right and left than up and down. It's what in the science of explosives would be called a shaped charge. In order to see an unsymmetric final state, this language of pressure and the like has to be valid early, because if you let this almond, if you let all the junk in this almond stream apart without any interaction for a time scale, say, comparable to its width, which might be 3 or 4 Fermi, then it'll circularize. And if then you turn on interactions only after 3 or 4 Fermis, you won't get an asymmetry. So if you see an asymmetry in the data, which you measure by this quantity V2 is the quadrupole moment of the azimuthal angle distribution. If you see a non-zero V2, it points in the direction of interactions. And the data from 2001 in red here show a non-zero V2 as a function of impact parameter. These are head-on collisions. These ones are grazing like I sketched on that cartoon. Okay, so it's not zero. What do you compare to? Well, you compare to the black boxes, which are calculations done using hydrodynamics. So these calculations were done starting with initial state like I showed you on the previous transparency and assuming that from time equals zero, you had zero mean free path, perfect ideal hydrodynamics. And there are many more tests of this hypothesis in the data, and they all work surprisingly well. In what sense surprising? Well, this is the crazy approximation. Ideal hydrodynamics is based on the assumption of local equilibrium from time zero. And it's a crazy approximation that never worked before Rick. Heavy ion collisions have been done at lower energies in the past, and there, this crazy approximation missed the data by factors of 2 always, 2 and more. So at Rick, hydrodynamics does a good job of describing V2 and other quantities that I'm not going to present. What does this mean? Well, you can quantify the statement that hydro has to work by early times, and that turns into this statement that in order to fit that data, you need hydrodynamics to be a good description already by this very early time. Just geometry tells you it has to be working well before 4 Fermis, and it turns out, in fact, it has to be working by before 1 Fermi. This is a real challenge to theory. How can a system equilibrate so fast or come to approximate local equilibrium so fast? I'm not going to actually describe the response to that challenge today, but people work on it. It also means that the shear viscosity has to be small. Why is that? Well, when this fluid explodes, there's shear in the flow. And if there were a large shear viscosity, then that shear would turn into heat. And so the shear viscosity would sort of sap away the collective flow kinetic energy and just turn it into heat. Instead, you get this large anisotropic flow. And so you can turn that into a quantitative statement, which Derek Tini was the first to do. It turns out that the dimensionless ratio that you can easily constrain from this data is the ratio of the shear viscosity eta to the entropy density S. And this dimensionless quantity, it turns out to be small, less than a tenth. What does less than a tenth mean? Well, eta over S for water is about 10. So a way of saying this is that the quark-gluon plasma at RIC is 100 times closer to the ideal liquid limit than water. And water is, of course, what hydrodynamics is named after. So hydrodynamics works very well. That's the first message from the data, that the experiments at RIC are suggesting that this quark-gluon plasma is so strongly coupled at the temperatures that are being accessed at RIC, presumably around 1.5 TC, that it's better thought of as a liquid than a gas. And my goodness, it is a very good liquid. It has 100 times smaller viscosity than water does in these units. And in fact, if you just do a calculation of this quantity in perturbative QCD, you miss the data by a factor of 10. So it's very strongly interacting. It's behaving like a liquid with very short mean free paths. Okay, so should this have been a surprise? This was the news of 2001 through 3. Should this have been a surprise? Well, the first answer is no, because at temperatures of a few times TC, if you just go back to those plots of the strength of the coupling versus scale, if you just look at those plots and look at them quantitatively, you would conclude that the coupling is not small. So really, with hindsight, this should not have been a surprise. But now, why was it a surprise? It was a surprise because of this plot. This plot showed from these lattice calculations that the energy density of this quark-gluon plasma here was within 20% of an ideal gas. This red benchmark here is the energy density of a quark-gluon plasma where the quarks and gluons don't interact at all. So it's the exact opposite of a liquid. And the community was seduced by that into the following false conclusion. There's nothing wrong with this plot, but the conclusion was the conclusion that, well, interactions are a 20% correction. When you think about it with hindsight, that is illogical, because how do you know where this curve would be if the interactions were very strong? All you know from this is that this is where QCD sits, but you don't, and you know that if there were no interactions, you'd be here. But where should this curve be if the interactions are very strong? And insight into this question comes from a surprising direction. Theorists like to think about gauge theories other than QCD. And one of the QCD's relatives is a supersymmetric theory. I understand that Eric gave a colloquium on supersymmetry last week. But this is a particular supersymmetric theory with a name, N equals 4. It's just a name. It's another theory. And Amanda Peet and colleagues calculated that in the limit of very strong coupling, the energy density over T to the fourth of this theory was 75% of its value in a non-interacting quark-gluon plasma. So when you crank the interactions from 0 to infinity, this quantity only changed from 100 to 75%. And Policastro and friends calculated that in this theory, eta over S, this ratio was 1 over 4 pi, which you'll notice is about 0.08, comparable to what you get for quark-gluon plasma from the data. So a posteriori, now nobody, this is 2007, now nobody thinks this is surprising anymore. After the data, people now are quite comfortable with the idea that as you go up the vertical axis of the phase diagram in QCD, you go from a gas of hadrons, presumably to a hadron liquid phase, then to a quark-gluon plasma liquid, which is what we're studying at RIC, and ultimately at some much higher temperature to the gas of quarks and gluons, but that's at a higher temperature that we haven't yet explored. And also a posteriori, and in this case after the string theorists, we realize that 80% is closer to 75% than it is to 1. Okay? So what the string theorists told us is that in a different theory, admittedly, in a different strong interaction gauge theory, the string theorist told us that if the interactions were infinitely strong, this line should be right about here. Okay? And when you hear that, the picture hangs together. You're no longer surprised by anything I've told you. Once you've sort of integrated in your head what we learned from experiment and what we learned from string theory. Okay. Two new developments. New within the last few months. First of all, from Harvey Meyer, postdoc named Harvey Meyer, the first honest calculation of 8 over S in QCD itself, not in some other gauge theory, but in QCD. These are preliminary lattice calculations. It's sort of like experimental physics when you do a lattice calculation. Results stay preliminary for a while until systematic effects, which in this case is finite volume effects, finite size effects, finite volume effects, finite lattice spacing effects are controlled. Preliminary results for the shear viscosity 8 over S as a function of temperature from 1 TC, 2 TC, 3 TC all lie around 0.1, say between 0.1 and 0.2. This is 1 over 4 pi. So they all seem to lie in the regime which is called for by the data and which is very close to what the string theory calculations gave us for the other theory. Very, very nice. Harvey has calculated the bulk viscosity also, and that's small, something which should be of interest to the theorists in the room. This is zero flavors. Sorry. And it says it on the transparency. It's zero flavors. Yeah, you got to walk before you can run. Okay, that's one new development. The other new development, from my point of view, left field, from Joe Thewissen's friends, is in a completely different context. Atomic physicists discovered elliptic flow also. They didn't call it that, but I can call it that. This is an image of made by the Duke Atomic Physics Group, John Thomas et al., of a cloud of cold atoms in a trap. This is a cigar-shaped trap. And these atoms are fermions, and the experimentalists have a beautiful trick that they can play where they can dial the strength of interaction between those fermions. And they make it, in a sense that I could make precise afterwards, infinitely strong. So these are strongly interacting fermions. They're not quarks and gluons. They're atoms. They're lithium atoms. And now you turn the trap off. So this, at time zero, you have this elliptical shape. Now you turn the trap off, and the thing explodes. And you can see with your eyes that it explodes with greater force left and right than up and down. So this is the same phenomenon that experimentalists in heavy ion physics use to extract a shear viscosity. And so it would, in fact, be possible to work out the shear viscosity of this gas, this fluid of cold atoms, from this data. But they have a better way of doing it because they can do better experiments than that. They can take that cloud of atoms, squeeze it, and let it ring. Whoops. And this is the breathing mode of that cloud, so you squeeze it and you let it ring, and you get this damped sinusoid. So you've squeezed it and you're letting it ring, and you can see it ringing over a time scale of milliseconds as it cools down. As it damps away. And if, big if here, if this damping is due to viscosity, then you can extract the shear viscosity. I'll show you the results in just a second, but they have a third way. They can take that cloud and give it a spin before letting it expand and study the expansion of a rotating cloud. And it turns out that the expansion of a rotating cloud is very sensitive to shear viscosity. And they make plots which look so much like the heavy ion plots that it's funny, even though the axes are different and every scale is very different. This is a plot of the angle of that cloud, how it rotates as a function of time. In gray is ideal hydrodynamics, and in green and yellow is put in some shear viscosity, and you can see that the data like ideal hydrodynamics better than shear viscosity. And then you do this quantitatively, and you extract from the physics of cold atoms 8 over S for a cloud of cold atoms. And 8 over S in units basically of temperature. They call it something else, but it's basically temperature. And this is what they get from that breathing mode, so you have the ringing of that squeeze it and let it ring experiment. This is from the rotating cloud. You can argue, you can convince yourself very quickly that if you squeeze something and let it ring radially, it's not very sensitive to shear viscosity. So probably much of the damping here is due to something else. So this should be seen as an upper bound. This is quite sensitive to shear viscosity, and look what they got. This is 1 over 4 pi. The quark-gluon plasma lives here just between 0.1 and 0.2. So now we have a system which is 20 orders of magnitude colder, and it has the same shear viscosity in units of its entropy density. This is amazing. I think nature, it seems like nature is trying to tell us something. We just have to figure out what. So let me say a little bit more. We're going to talk more as we go forward, but let me say a little bit more right now about the string theory case. We now know of an infinite class of gauge theories, not just n equals 4, all of which are equivalent to string theories in higher dimensional space-times, and all of whose quark-gluon plasmas have these two properties that I've highlighted, namely that their energy density is 3/4 the ideal gas value, and their eta over s is 1 over 4 pi. So we now know of infinitely many examples of this. And all the gauge theories for which we know this rigorously are equivalent to a string theory. So the question which we are driven to is there some new notion of universality for nearly scale-invariant liquids? All these fluids that I've described have only a single scale, and that scale is the temperature. So they're nearly scale-invariant. And they all seem to have common properties, in particular this 8 over S. So to what systems does this apply? The three examples that I've mentioned are the quark-gluon plasmas that are equivalent to string theories, the quark-gluon plasma in the real world, and this gas of atoms. Well, are these the only examples? And to what quantities does it apply? So far, I've talked only about really one quantity, 8 over S. So what I want to do now is I want to talk about another quantity. And nobody has done atom-quenching experiments, so I will not talk further about these cold atom experiments. I'll talk about these two cases, and I'll introduce a new quantity, which will also allow us to compare experiments at RIC to string theory calculations. So the new quantity comes from a new phenomenon called jet quenching, discovered by RIC. And this is the other big experimental discovery at RIC. So what is the phenomenon? Well, here is that blob of quark-gluon plasma. And let's say that right there at that green dot, at time zero, I had a hard scattering event, which if this green dot was just an isolated proton-proton collision, would have made a 10 to 20 GeV jet of particles going to the right and a 10 to 20 GeV jet of particles going to the left. What happens at RIC instead is that you see this jet, and you then say, okay, I've seen a jet here. Let's go look over here at 180 degrees away and look for the jet that carries the recoiling momentum, and you find that there is no jet. Instead, you find that there is an excess of a few hundred much, much lower energy particles. So what this experiment is telling you is that you started with a high energy quark, which in vacuum would have become a high energy jet. But that quark wasn't in vacuum. It was in this red soup, this red liquid. And as it fought its way through that liquid, it just got thermalized. It got slowed down and turned into lots of soft excitations. This is the physics of jet quenching. And when you quantify this effect in a way that I will describe partially, it turns out that the effect is bigger than expectations based on perturbative weak coupling QCD calculations. It's quantified in terms of a parameter which, for historical reasons, is called Q hat. And this jet quenching parameter in whatever units is 5 to 25 times bigger. What you need to explain the data is 5 to 25 times bigger than what you get if you just calculate in perturbative weak coupling QCD. So before elucidating that further, let me just show you data. You can see this effect with your eyes. So what is the experiment here? You say, I've seen one high-energy particle, very high-energy particle, say 10 GeV, which is high energy for RIC. And then you ask, let me look at all the other high-energy particles, say particles with momentum between 2 and 10 GeV, and let me look at all of them as a function of angle relative to the first one that I triggered on. And you find that there's a pileup near the first one at 0 degrees, that's the jet. And then you look over here at 180 degrees, and if you do proton-proton collisions, you see a pileup. If you do proton-nucleus collisions, you see a pileup. And if you do gold-gold collisions, you see no pileup. So this is the discovery of what you might call monojets. You see a jet going one way, you look the other side, there's no jet. But, of course, momentum must be conserved, so there has to be something. And when you look on the other side in a more sophisticated way, you see a large absence in those soft particles, so you've made more quark-gluon plasma. Okay, so that's a look at the data. How do you describe this theoretically? Well, the way that a high-energy particle loses energy when it goes through matter, you can ask about this for electrons. If I shoot an electron through this table, how does it lose energy? Well, in the limit of high energy, so if I take an electron from the Slack accelerator and shoot it through this table, it loses energy by radiating photons, Bremsstrahlung. And the same is true for high-energy quarks. They lose energy by radiating gluons. And so you have a quark coming along, it's radiated a gluon, but the incident quark, the outgoing quark, and the radiated gluon are all being buffeted by this medium. And if you're in the high-energy limit, then this process, the cartooned here, dominates energy loss. And if so, then the energy loss turns out to be sensitive to this red medium through only one parameter, which is the amount of buffeting you get per distance traveled. It's the amount of momentum kick that you get transverse to the direction you're going per distance you travel. And what might you expect for that parameter? Well, if you just use your perturbative intuition from before the experiments were done, i.e., what would you expect if that medium were weakly coupled? Well, then this amount of buffeting you get should go like, I'll just skip to here, it should go like the number density of scatterers times some dimensionless measure of how strong the cross-section is between you and the things that you're scattering off of. So if you can describe your medium as well-separated scatterers with weak interactions, then this is the answer you get. And notice that the number density of scatterers goes like number of colors squared times t cubed, and then this becomes the alpha squared. And you plug numbers in, it's about one in these units. So then you ask, what do you get from data? And this is a long story, but I'll just show you. This is a plot from the experimental Phoenix collaboration of a probability of, so what is the, given their data and given their analysis, which I could describe, but it would not be appropriate for a colloquium, given their data, what is the most likely value of Q hat? Well, the most likely value is about 15, but the range of possibilities is between 5 and 25. So this parameter, it's a property of the quark-gluon plasma at RIC. It's not yet very well constrained, but it sure doesn't look like it can be 1. So weak coupling QCD predicts 1. Data requires something larger. So now what you ask is, well, how can we calculate the properties of a strongly coupled quark-gluon plasma? Lattice QCD is great for thermodynamics, but not for jet quenching. Perturbative QCD, that has the virtue of being a calculation in which you're using the right theory, but it's the wrong approximation. Perturbative QCD should not be good if you have a strongly interacting liquid. So these have been the workhorses of theory in the subject for 30 years, and they don't work in this regime for this question. So we theorists have been driven to doing the following, following the following strategy. Let's calculate the properties of quark-gluon plasmas in the wrong theories. So in these other gauge theories. These other gauge theories have the virtue that they're analyzable at strong coupling, and we can then ask, are dynamical properties universal? And we saw that this worked for 8 over S. This strategy seems to work for 8 over S. Does it work for the jet quenching parameter? And a way to think about this is that nature is cruel to experimentalists by only giving them one quark-gluon plasma to study. Okay? Condensed matter physicists are much, much luckier. When condensed matter physicists discovered high-TC superconductivity, within months, there were dozens of examples to study. In QCD, there's only one quark-gluon plasma. And it's the fact that in condensed matter physics, you have dozens of examples that allows you to discern what properties of a high-TC material are common across all of them and what are annoying little details, like whether it's strontium or bismuth, which is a detail. And so theorists are now doing this. Experimentalists can't, but theorists can. We're studying quark-gluon plasmas in many theories and starting to learn what quantities are common to many quark-gluon plasmas and what are details. So what I want to do, by the way, where's Eric? I'm assuming that I have an hour from when I started. Okay. So what I want to do now is I'm going to explain to you how to do a string theory calculation. And I'm not a string theorist, by the way, so if I can do it, you can do it. But before I do, I'm going to tell you the answer. So we calculated the jet quenching parameter in this other gauge theory, and you can do so analytically. It comes out to being a number times t cubed, and that number, even before we ask what this means numerically, that number goes like the square root of the number of colors. It's not proportional to the number of colors squared. That means that this quantity, this jet quenching parameter, is not counting scatterers. Somehow it's seeing the medium in a more collective way. It's not counting scatterer here, scatterer here, scatterer there. Okay? So this is a qualitative fact that I think will carry over to QCD, even if the number game that I'll play now turns out to be over-optimistic. I think that the perturbative intuition for what this jet quenching parameter is inapplicable in a strongly interacting liquid. Now you plug in numbers and you find you get 5. And 5 is right at the bottom edge of what the data requires. It's much better than 1. So when you plug in numbers, you find that the Q-hat of this wrong theory is comparable to the Q-hat that you seem to need from RIC data for QCD. And it certainly does better than the weakly coupled calculation. Okay, so, well, how do you do a string theory calculation? What is the trick here? The trick is that this gauge theory, this N equals, this friend of QCD, is secretly exactly the same as string theory in the following funny space. This is a five-dimensional this is a space with 5 big dimensions and 5 curled up ones. And now you should all be objecting, because we last time any of you checked, we lived in 3 plus 1 dimensions, not 4 plus 1. And here I am telling you that this theory, its calculation is done in 4 plus 1 big dimensions. So something must be, either I made a mistake or something I have to tell you still. Before I tell you how that works, let me just stress that the string theory and the gauge theory are both specified by 3 numbers, and you can make a one-to-one mapping between them. The string coupling constant and this quantity in the string theory side are equivalent to the coupling constant in QCD and the number of colors. In the Super-Yang-Mills theory and the number of colors. So there's this precise equivalence between the parameters here and the parameters there. And the temperature of the gauge theory, I have a quark-gluon plasma at temperature T. Well, all you have to do, Maldacena and Witten and folks like that tell us, is put in a black hole in your string theory in the five-dimensional space, and the Hawking temperature of that five-dimensional black hole is the same as the temperature of the quark-gluon plasma. So this sounds bizarre, and what I want to do is demystify it. I want to explain how strings that live in 5 dimensions can describe phenomena that we experience in 4. And I won't do it, I won't do it for Q hat, I'll do it for a simpler quantity. How would you calculate the force between a quark and an antiquark? Well, if you are a lattice QCD person, restricting your imagination to 3 plus 1 dimensions, you build a big computer and you calculate the fluctuations of the gauge fields around this quark and this antiquark, symbolized here by these green dots, in this 3 plus 1 dimensional space where we live, and you do a very, very hard calculation, it takes you teraflop years, and you get an answer. If you're Maldacena, you realize that actually this particular gauge theory is equivalent to a string theory living in 5 dimensions, and the quark and the antiquark should be thought of as the endpoints of a string which dangles down in 5 dimensions because this 5th dimension is curved. And objects in curved space-time feel forces of gravity. So there's a string hanging down here. And if you want to calculate the force between quark and antiquark, all you do is solve the catenary problem, which we learned how to do as undergraduates. You extremize the energy of this string, this chain hanging here, and differentiate the answer with respect to the separation, and that's the force. So this is, in fact, how you do the calculation. And why is it so simple? It's simple because of 2 limits. First of all, this is the right answer only if I assume that G squared NC is large. G squared NC is the often called the Etoupe coupling. That translates on the string theory side into a high tension for the string and says you can ignore fluctuations of the string. And second of all, you have to assume that the number of colors is large, and that translates into the statement that in the string theory, loops never break off of this string. So if on the gauge theory side you are willing to ask questions at large number of colors and large coupling, then the string theory calculation becomes very easy. It becomes an undergraduate classical mechanics problem. Strong coupling, well, that's what we want. We're trying to study a strongly coupled quark gluon plasma. Large NC, this is more dubious because the number of colors in QCD is only 3. But we take what we can get. Okay, so how might confinement arise in this description? Well, if you start pulling this quark and antiquark apart, if that string in the fifth dimension starts to do this, namely it starts to, as you separate the quark and the antiquark further and further, the string starts to go behave as shown here, then you can see that as I, if this is what's happening, then the force will be constant with separation. That's called confinement. And this phenomenon, confinement, does not occur in N equals 4 super Young Mills theory. And so you should not use this friend of QCD that I just I'm using here. You should not use it to study protons and neutrons. But you can use it to study the quark gluon plasma, because in a quark gluon plasma, the force between quarks and antiquarks is screened by the medium. How does screening by the medium get described in this gravity theory? Well, here you start pulling the quark and the antiquark apart, and you reach a certain separation called the screening length, at which, hey, wait a minute, you can no longer find a solution that looks like this. Instead, the strings hang down to this black hole horizon, which is sitting here. This, remember, this black hole is like the heat bath, keeping the theory warm, and it has a horizon, strings hang down to it. And now when you start pulling the quarks and antiquarks farther apart, the force between them is 0. So if I ask how screening in the N equals 4 theory works, the potential between a static quark and antiquark at 0 temperature turns out to be Coulomb-like. It goes like 1 over L. And at high temperatures, at non-zero temperatures, it's Coulomb-like. Then it gets to be then you hit a screening length here, and then it's 0. There's no force. Potential is constant. So how does this compare to QCD? In QCD, you can study screening also on the lattice. These are lattice calculations of the screened potential between quark and antiquark in QCD at non-zero temperature. And if I look at one of these high-temperature curves, it looks a lot like what you got in that wrong theory. It's Coulomb-like, and then it's flat. It doesn't have that kink, but it's Coulomb-like, then it's flat. At lower temperatures where QCD is confined, you get a different behavior, this linear rise here. But at high temperatures, QCD force between quarks looks like that in the other theory. So that's an example of how you do a calculation in string theory in 5 dimensions of the force between a quark and an antiquark. That's not actually of interest phenomenologically, because we know how to do that calculation in QCD long before the string theorists came along. But what Hong and Urs and I realized is that with a very, very simple extension of the calculation I just described, we could do something that had never been done in QCD and make a prediction for experiment. So before I come back to QHAT, let me tell you about that. So we said, well, let's make our quark and antiquark move through the plasma. That then turns it into a dynamics problem. The lattice folks can't deal with it, but it's just now, it's still an undergraduate classical mechanics problem when viewed from the string theory side. So we calculated the screening length, and I'll just skip to the simplest form of the answer. We found that the screening length shrinks with velocity, like 1 over the square root of Lorentz gamma. So as you move the quark and antiquark faster and faster, the screening length shrinks like 1 over square root of gamma, like 1 minus v squared to the 1/4 power. Now, how does this lead to a prediction? Well, in QCD, there are heavy quarks. I haven't talked about them till this moment, but called charm and bottom. And there are bound states of charm, anti-charm, and bottom, anti-bottom, called J psi and upsilon. And these bound states dissociate when the temperature reaches a certain temperature at which the screening length is about roughly the meson size. And this makes perfect sense. If I have a small bound state, it's bound until the force between the quark and the antiquark gets screened at the length scale of the size of the object. And that means that, so the dissociation temperature is the temperature at which the screening length is the size of the bound state. Into this, dissociation temperature for moving mesons should be lower than the dissociation temperature for still mesons. And then you make a prediction that, when you put together all that's known about the physics of J psi mesons at RIC, it's a consistent story, consistent with data from RIC and lower energy experiments that came before, that the JSi mesons are happily bound still at Rick temperatures of 1.5 Tc, and they only dissociate at temperatures more like 2 Tc if they're at rest. This is a story that, I just oversimplified a lot of phenomenology right there. But our observation is if that's true, then start looking at moving JSi mesons and they should melt, because if they're moving with a momentum bigger than about 5 GeV, the dissociation temperature should drop below 1.5 Tc. So we suggest to look at JSi mesons with transverse momentum bigger than around 5 GeV. The state of the data is that at Rick, there is low statistics data on JSi mesons at, say, 2 to 4 GeV. The reach in transverse momentum will extend. I'll show you a propaganda plot from the experimentalists. RIC 2 is a proposed upgrade of RIC for which funding is currently being sought. And the claim from the experimentalists making plots like this is that if you build the upgrade, you'll be able to get JSi's out to 10 GeV. And our prediction is that somewhere around here, which has not been explored, you should see a dramatic decrease in the number of JSi's because they won't be able to stay bound in the medium when they're moving that fast. So there's a prediction for experiments to come. And if you ask what went into it, it's a string theory calculation plus all that phenomenology that I skipped. So it's not just a string theory calculation. There was a lot more to it, but a key piece was a calculation that nobody was able to do before, and we did because we have these new methods. Okay, so now, if it wasn't for the fact that I have only 10 minutes, I would tell you about how you calculate Q hat. I'm not going to do that. It does, in fact, boil down to solving a catenary problem. This time, the string hanging between the quark and the antiquark are separated by a distance L, which translates to the transverse momentum of the radiated gluon, and this quark and the antiquark are moving at the speed of light. So there are technical differences which turn into interesting facts for a theoretical seminar. But for the colloquium, it's just like before. It's just as easy as the thing I convinced you that an undergraduate can do. I'm not even going to tell you how to calculate 8 over S. That's a different style of calculation, but also now well understood. So what I want to end with is, we have found that Q hat calculated in the wrong theory, this N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, seems to be comparable to Q hat required by experiments at RIC. So Q hat in QCD as evidenced for by what's required by experiments at RIC. So this is a very loose wiggle right now because for lots of reasons. And I want to discuss the issues that are in this wiggle. So what are the issues on both sides of this comparison? Well, first of all, the extraction from data was very loose. It was 5 to 25. So why is it so loose? First of all, the most important reason really is that the extraction is neglecting energy loss by any process other than gluon radiation. And gluon radiation does dominate for high enough energy jets, but it's not clear that RIC collisions actually provide us with high enough energy jets. At RIC, these jets have 10 GeV of energy, 20 GeV at the most. And at the LHC, which will begin operation next year as a proton-proton collider and the year afterwards as a heavy ion collider, there will be 100, in fact, 200 GeV jets. So everything that RIC has been able to do at sort of the qualitative level should become much more precise, turn to much more precise measurements at the LHC because you'll actually be able to see the jets, study their modification, define more discriminating observables, really go to town on this subject. So the message about what's going to get better with the extraction of Q hat from data is wait for the LHC. Now, what about on the theory side? Well, the way that I would think about this is in some sort of an abstract space of theories, here's N equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. Here's QCD. This is a space with many axes. I would like to see whether I can start here and take steps in that direction towards the real world and see how Q hat changes as I go that way in the space of theories. So, what are the differences between this theory and this theory? This transparency is a list of differences between the two theories, and it's disconcertingly long. The degrees of freedom are different. QCD has fewer degrees of freedom. This N equals 4 theory has more degrees of freedom. So you need observables that can scale out this difference. And 80 over S is the classic example. You might worry about the fact that QCD seems to have a different number of degrees of freedom and different, some, and the color quantum numbers are different, but we won't talk about that here. But let me remind you that liquids have no well-defined quasi-particles anyway. So if you're talking about a phase of both of these theories, which is liquid-like, maybe this difference doesn't matter so much as long as you choose the right variables. Now, N equals 4 is conformal. What that word means is that it has no scale except the temperature. That's a precise statement for this other theory. In QCD, we know that QCD is not conformal. There are scales galore in QCD. The mass of the proton is a scale. The mass of the rho meson is a scale. The mass of anything else you like is a scale. But those are scales associated with the hadrons. In the quark-gluon plasma, the thermodynamics of QCD turns out to be quite conformal. And the evidence for that, one piece of evidence is the flatness of this curve. Another piece of evidence is the smallness of the bulk viscosity that Harvey Meyer was calculating. So maybe strongly interacting quark-gluon plasma is well modeled as conformal, even though the theory as a whole in other contexts is not. Finally, these N equals 4 calculations are only tractable when the number of colors is large and the coupling is strong. This one we like because the coupling in the quark-gluon plasma is strong. This one we would love for string theorists to be able to calculate the 1 over NC squared corrections to any of these quantities that are calculated with these methods, and so far that's not possible. Okay, so I'm near the end. Let me just say that in recent theoretical work, I and my collaborators, I should have said my collaborators' names before, Hong Liu is at MIT, Urs Wiedemann is at CERN, we have shown that within, I'll put it up, for any conformal theory, so remember, so I want to talk about three things. Conformality, number of degrees of freedom. I'll stop with those two. Let's talk about two of the things on that list. Conformality and number of degrees of freedom. So in any conformal theory, so don't mess with the conformality, but change the number of degrees of freedom, we've shown that Q hat of any other theory that's still conformal, its ratio to the Q hat of this N equals 4 theory that we started with goes like the square root of their entropy densities. So that means that that suggests that Q hat goes like the square root of a quantity A that counts number of degrees of freedom. Okay? So this is our suggestion for the new intuition that should replace the perturbative intuition. And if you take this intuition and apply it numerically, you would say that Q hat in QCD, so if you boldly just apply this intuition to QCD, which is not conformal, then you would say that Q hat in QCD should be down from what we had by about a factor of 0.6. But now you start thinking about corrections to conformality, and this is the result of a calculation done by Yeming Shi, who is in fact an undergraduate, thus demonstrating by experiment that these calculations can be done by undergraduates. We gave Yeming a deformation of this N equals 4 theory, which introduces non-conformality. It was a deformation invented by these Finnish people, Finnish and Korean people. And Yeming calculated Q hat in this deformed theory and found that for reasonable values of the non-conformality, Q hat goes up by 10 to 20%. So what I've just told you is that of all the different ways that this theory, the wrong one, and this one, the theory of quarks in nature, differ, I've taken steps in this direction along two different axes. And with respect to one change, I found that my quantity went down by 40%. With respect to the other change, it went up by 20%. So if we're doing more of this, theorists are doing more of this, and if this is the message that continues, then it becomes not surprising that our result over here is in broad agreement with what we need from experiment over here. So what you want here, the wish list for the theoretical side is, you want examples where this Q hat can be calculated as you reduce the number of degrees of freedom. You want I'll skip this one. You want examples where you can calculate Q hat as you make corrections to the strength of the coupling. We've assumed it's infinite. It's not infinite. This work has started on this also. You'd like examples where you could calculate corrections to this NC squared goes to infinity limit. I've talked about QHAT in this end part of my talk, but let me just advertise that this three-quarters of this program is completed for the 80 over S quantity. So for 80 over S, we actually have a much better understanding than for QHAT of why it works so well, because people have done all of this very well. This one still remains. And if there's a universality under here, that would be great to a theorist. If it turns out that after calculating Q-hat in varied gauge theories with dual descriptions, we decide that the ratio of Q-hat, there should be a square root over this bottom. Q-hat over square root of S normalized appropriately, the bottom here should be under square root. If that's universal in the same sense that 8 over S is, well, first of all, that would be great as a theoretical discovery. It would give us some sense that this universality applied to more than one quantity. Or even if we don't believe that, suppose that we understand enough by playing this game of varying the theory in theory space and seeing how Q-hat changes. Suppose we believe that we know that Q-hat in QCD is square root of A times square root of lambda, which is the coupling, times T cubed. And suppose that we understand this free factor at the factor of 4 level, the thing under the square root of the factor of 4 level. Then, just from the purely phenomenological point of view, this would have an enormous impact in heavy ion physics, because Q-hat would then be a thermometer for the early time. We have no way of sticking a thermometer into the quark-gluon plasma because it only lives for 10 to the minus 22 seconds. But Q-hat would then be a way. This probe of the plasma would tell us the temperature with a calibration energy uncertainty of only 2 to the 1/3. And the biggest weakness of the subject right now is that there's no experimental test of this plot with which we began. To test this plot, to test this prediction of QCD, you need to measure not just the energy density, which is easy, but the temperature at an early time. And no one has been able to do that. But this combination of new theoretical developments and new experimental measurements of jet quenching may lead to a measure of the early time temperature and hence to a test of the lattice calculations, which kicked this subject off 25 years ago. Okay, so last transparency. What are we learning from this combination of experiments and string theory? I think we are gaining qualitative and, I would argue, semi-quantitative insights and even predictions regarding the properties of strongly interacting quark-gluon plasma. It's also clear to me that string theory is useful as a source of new calculational techniques. It opens previously intractable regime to calculation. These two, I'll stand by. This one would be nice. I think it's not yet demonstrated. Maybe it will be over time. Perhaps the quark-gluon plasma in QCD at a temperatures of a few TC is close to, or maybe even in the same, it may be even equivalent to a string theory in a curved five-dimensional space-time containing a black hole. And that would be an amazing discovery, that the quark-gluon plasma in the real world that you can make in an experiment is in the same universality class or equivalent in some sense we don't yet understand to a string theory in five dimensions. We, as a combination of theorists and experimentalists in this field, are groping towards answering that question by, in a sense, we're trying to figure out what the word universality might mean here. And, you know, it seems to apply to a cloud of cold atoms tuned to be strongly interacting also. So it must be have a relatively broad applicability, but we don't know how to define its applicability. And finally, could the successes of this approach, of the successful comparison of string theory calculations to RIC experiments, could that be telling us that QCD itself is, in all contexts, secretly equivalent to a string theory? To me, is too strong, but there are some people who speculate in this direction. And I'll stop there.
So
that's both great questions. Bulk viscosity, I think that, first of all, nothing is known experimentally to answer those questions, but theoretically I can tell you several things. First of all, bulk viscosity, those same early preliminary results from Harvey Meyer show a bulk viscosity which is very small, above about 1.5 to 2 TC, but gets quite large very close to the critical temperature. So in the crossover regime, there's a significant bulk viscosity. And so as these droplets cool through the transition, there's a bulk viscosity. That is what these preliminary calculational results suggest. And in a conformal fluid, there's no bulk viscosity. So you can't use these N equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theories and string theory techniques to study the crossover. You can only study the high temperature phase. Surface tension, I think nobody, there are model calculations of the surface tension between quark gluon plasma and vacuum. It's hard, a little bit hard to define because you can't have a static situation where you have quark gluon plasma and vacuum. The quark gluon plasma explodes. There are also model calculations of the surface tension of a hadron. You can think of a single proton as a little drop of in which there are quarks surrounded by some kind of a surface which keeps the vacuum out. That's called the bag model. In the bag model, you can calculate the surface tension. And in the bag model, it turns out to be mathematically identically zero. In the limit of massless quarks, and it is a calculable value when the quarks have a mass. That's a bit far from a quark gluon plasma to vacuum surface tension, and the latter, I think, is only discussed relatively crudely. Yes. So I love that idea, and to me, that's I don't know how to make this insight quantitative, but that is my picture in my own head of hadronization. You have this exploding droplet of quark gluon plasma, and it fragments into smaller droplets, and the smallest droplets are the protons that come out. That's to me, a very nice picture. It's not something that I know how to make in a quantitative way. So if you have an idea for how to make that quantitative, we should talk.
Yes. Makes sense. In other words, have people.
Well, okay, good.
Hydrodynamics, or do they right. simply assume it from undergraduate terms?
No, this is a question which we can't ask our experimental friends yet, but it's a fair question to ask the theorists. So on the theory side, when a theorist like Harvey Meyer says shear viscosity, what does he mean? He means he takes the stress energy tensor, the T mu nu 2-point function, and calculates that 2-point function, and from it uses a Kubo formula to extract a shear viscosity in the zero frequency limit. So it's exactly what you would define in condensed matter physics via a Kubo formula. And that's what he's calculated, and that's what he has calculated in a preliminary fashion, and I showed his results. If we now ask, what do the experimentalists mean? I think it's equivalent to that, but operationally it's different. What they mean is that they, first of all, compare their data on how the system expands. They compare their data to a calculation done using inviscid hydrodynamics, ideal hydrodynamics. And then what is just starting to happen is to do relativistic hydrodynamics with non-zero viscosity. And to me, that doesn't sound, well, to me at first hearing, that doesn't sound so hard. Just simulate the Navier-Stokes equation. But the Navier-Stokes equation has numerical instabilities if you try and simulate it for relativistic flows. And so you have to use what's called the Israel-Stewart formalism to do these simulations, which is a higher-order formalism where you include higher derivative terms. And that's something which now three groups of theorists that I know are doing, and there are preliminary results from that too, and I have them in the pile of transparencies, but I didn't show them. So I think certainly in the lattice calculation of the shear viscosity, it's exactly what you mean. If you like the Israel-Stewart formalism, then it's the same there too. If you know of a better formalism than Israel Stewart for relativistic viscous hydro, you should tell me about it.
Time for
one more question.
No?
Oh.
Joe.
Would you say that you had, you get something like 5?
Yeah.
And you adjust it down by 40%.
And then back up by 20%.
Back up by 20%. And then that's in broad agreement with the data.
Right.
I keep remembering this plot, which had a histogram.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Right. Yeah. Okay. Very good. So now I'm gonna do what theorists should never do, which is criticize the plots of experimentalists. Actually, there's nothing wrong with the plot. I'm gonna describe some of the dirty laundry that the experimentalists sweep under the rug in making that plot. If I can find the plot again. Yeah. No, but there's an important thing I didn't mention. So I have to tell you now how they did it, which is this side, which I didn't talk about in the colloquium. So this is a plot of a quantity called RAA. What is that? This is the number of particles with, say, 10 GeV transverse momentum that you get relative to what you expect if there were no quark gluon plasma around and you just did proton-proton collisions in vacuum. And so because some of the jets get quenched, you see far fewer jets, far fewer high-energy particles than you would have expected by a factor of more than 5. So this is one way of quantifying jet quenching. And the way the experimentalists did this extraction is they only used this one observable, this RAA, and they asked what RAA do you get for different values of Q hat, and then they did a chi-squared analysis, which is basically this. And what you see here is that their best fit by I is around Q hat of 13. Q hat of 5 is down here. But the main thing you should see is that as you crank up Q hat, these curves start to pile up closer and closer together. And there's a very simple reason for this, which is that no matter how big you make Q hat, you will always see the jets that originate on the surface. And nuclei don't have sharp edges. They have a profile. So there's always a halo. You'll always see some jets around the surface. And so to me, as you do better in this pile can only move leftwards. And really what I've told you is that I don't trust this side of it. This has to move leftwards as things are done better. The way you do things better is you don't look at 20 GeV jets anymore. You start to look at 200 GeV jets. 200 GeV jets will just punch right through and come out the other side. So a beautiful LHC experiment is you look for a jet recoiling against a Z boson. I'm in Canada. It's a real pleasure to say Zed again. So at the LHC, not at RIC, but at the LHC, you can have hard collisions which say a quark from here and a gluon from there scatter into a jet and a Zed. The Zed comes out without ever seeing the quark gluon plasma because Zeds are weakly interacting. They don't see quarks and gluons. They just fly out. They turn into muons, which just fly out and are seen by the experimentalist. So the experimentalist sees the muons over the two muons from the Zed, knows what was the energy of the Z, and that means you know from experiment what the initial energy of the quark going this way was. And now you look at the jet on this side and you see how much energy it's lost. How has it been degraded? And this should now be not quenching, but degradation. It should be turning 200 GeV jets into 150 GeV jets. And with that kind of an experiment, you'll first of all have more observables. You won't be doing this just with one observable. Second of all, the calculations will be under better control. And finally, the last thing is that if you look in the guts of what they extract, actually what is naturally extracted is the product of Q hat times the distance traveled. And in other words, how close to the surface was the jet that you saw originating? And if you made a histogram of Q hat times distance traveled, it would be much tighter. And a lot of this spread comes from modeling how far the distance, how much distance was in fact traveled, and all of that will become much easier if you have jets that are punching through. So there are a lot of reasons why. So one possibility, by the way, it could be that at the LHC the story changes completely and this histogram collapses down, squeezes down, and comes into agreement with what you expect from perturbative QCD for the LHC. That's why you got to do the experiments. But I think right now, I would not make a strong statement. I would just say we're closer. You know, we sit here at 5, perturbative QCDs at 1. We're closer to this pile. This pile is going to move.